out of the anti-white system and tune in to the pro-white system at radioarian.com.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Friday, the 1st of June, 2018. You are, of course, listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at radioarian.com. And today is the fifth part of our series on lost white civilizations, where we are basically providing the evidence for the fact that white people originally started civilizations in India, in China, in Egypt, in the Middle East, and today we are going to be looking at white people in America. Because white people, you know, we have not just been in Europe. We may call ourselves European today, but that is, it's a bit of a deceitful title for us. This is why I prefer the word Aryan, because it's not geographically bound to any specific area, and white people have never been geographically bound to any specific area. We are conquerors, we are explorers, we are civilization builders. In fact, all the civilizations on Earth that have ever existed were begun by white people, and I hope this series has shown that. And also where we've been using March of the Titans by Arthur Kemp as our source material, who is quite an anti-Christian writer, because a lot of the time it gets accused of just being some weird Christian identity idea that white people started these other civilizations. And it's not. It's fact. It's got nothing to do with religion. Anyway, so we're going to be looking at America today in our fifth and final episode of the series. And we're going to be reading from Chapter 6 in March of the Titans by Arthur Kemp. To the Ends of the Earth, Lost White Migrations, White Types in North America, 7000 BC. One of the most enigmatic of the lost Great White Migrations is the existence of skeletal remains in North America. These date from as early as 7000 BC, appear to be white in nature, and most certainly are not Native American, or Amerind, whose racial traits are Mongoloid or Asiatic, derived from the original homeland of the Amerind peoples. And I'll just interject here. When the Red Indians were first discovered, it was known that they were a mixed race. And if you look at the racial literature of the time, they say that the Red Indians were not a pure race. They were a mixture of different races. So it was known back then that miscegenation is the cause of the Indians. But miscegenation is also the source of the Arabs. Both those peoples were created by miscegenation. They're not pure races, and this has been known for a long time. Back to the book. It is beyond dispute that white tribes reached China. Compared to the distances those whites travelled, it would have been a relatively short hop across the rest of Asia to the Bering Straits, which divide Asia and North America, and then on into the North American continent. This was exactly how the Amerinds got to North America. There was no reason why advanced groups of whites could not have travelled this route even before the Amerinds. It is equally possible that early whites could have sailed from Western Europe, hugging the last ice pack along its coastline past present-day Greenland. Other evidence, which we will review later, supports this possibility. In 1940, a mummified and well-preserved body was unearthed in the Spirit Cave complex, located in the American state of Nevada. The mummy's scalp was complete, and skin remained on the back and shoulders. On the head, there was a small tuft of straight, dark hair, which changed to reddish-brown when exposed to light. Artifacts discovered in the spirit cave totaled some 67 items, including knives, baskets, and animal bones. The mummy was lying on a fur blanket, dressed in a twisted skin robe with leather shoes on its feet and a twined mat sewn around its head and shoulders. A similar mat was wrapped around the lower portion of the body. Two bags contained cremation ashes and bone fragments. The style of weaving used in the textiles is known as diamond plaited matting. This is a complex system requiring a high degree of sophistication in material manufacture technology that would have rivaled any on the planet at the time. The corpse became known as the Spirit Cave Mummy and was placed in the Nevada State Museum's storage facility for decades. Only in 1994 was the mummy rediscovered and the startling truth revealed. Tests showed that the corpse was 9,400 years old, a 45 to 55-year-old male, and most importantly, not an ancestor of any modern Indian tribe. The age was determined by performing 7 separate radiocarbon dating tests on samples of bone, hair, and the 2 reed mats in which he was buried. The Spirit Cave Mummy's white racial traits are undeniable. It has a long, small face and a large cranium, in sharp contrast to the mongoloid features of American Indians. The Spirit Cave Mummy represents some form of non-Amerind and most likely white settlement or incursion into North America around the year 7000 BC. The Nevada State Museum went public with its findings on the mummy in 1996, and it immediately sparked a furor, with the American Indians demanding that the corpse be reburied in accordance with tribal custom, falsely claiming the Spirit Cave Mummy as one of their own. The Amerind tribe involved, the Paiutes, laid claim to the corpse under an American law, the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act of 1990, which allows for the return and reburial of bodies of Native Americans. An extended legal dispute arose over the issue of ownership. As part of the legal wrangling, the Paiute have consistently refused to allow DNA testing of the corpse. This is not the only case where American Indians have blocked the study of obviously non-Amerind remains. Another case, that of the Kennewick Man, was similarly held up by Indian objections, and in 1993 another skeleton was found near Buell in the state of Idaho. The latter remains were some 10,600 years old, making them the oldest ever found in North America. The skeleton was turned over to local Indians, the Shoshone-Bannock tribe, and reburied before any comprehensive testing could be undertaken. In this way, several unique anthropological specimens have already been given to and buried by Indian tribes. In Montana, naturally shed human hair discovered by one archaeologist elicited an Amerind claim. Although the hair had not been buried in any kind of ritual, the US federal government has prevented testing of the hair to commence. The reason for the American Indian sensitivity over the issue is obvious. Proof that whites, even if only in small numbers, walked the continent of North America before the Amerinds themselves would undermine the latter's claim to be the original Native Americans. For the sake of political correctness, much valuable scientific data is being suppressed. On July the 28th, 1996, another dramatic find was made in the state of Washington, in the northwestern United States. On that day, a well-preserved skeleton was found in the Columbia River in Kennewick. This skeleton has become known as Kennewick Man. The nearly intact skeletal remains, found with a stone arrowhead lodged in the pelvic bone, are so clearly non-Amerind and so close to white that forensic anthropologists and local police first thought them to be those of a 19th century white male, about 45 years old, who was killed by an arrow. Radiocarbon dating of a finger bone, however, showed it to have great age, at least 9,000 years old, putting the individual on the North American continent around the year 7200 BC. Like the Spirit Cave Mummy, Kennewick Man's white racial traits are the cause of much controversy, local American Indian tribes filed claims for possession of Kennewick Man, and after a protracted legal dispute, scientists won the right to forensically examine the remains. Initial examination of Kennewick Man's skull indicated a likely white, even Nordic, cranial structure, differing greatly from the mongoloid skull shape of American Indians. The man was a little over 5.5 feet tall and of slender build. The skull is dolichocranial with a cranial index of 73.8 rather than brachycranic, the face narrow rather than broad and flat. The average cranial index for Nordic racial types is 74. Other features are a long, broad nose that projects markedly from the face and high, round orbits. The mandible is V-shaped with a pronounced deep chin. Many of these characteristics are definitive of present-day white peoples. Other nearby finds of bone, needles, close to the Kennewick Man's remains, assume that he may possibly have worn tailored clothing. These astonishing finds reveal that Kennewick Man was not alone, but that he lived in a community of some numbers. In October 1999, the US government issued a report on Kennewick Man, claiming that the skeletal remains possibly resembled the Ainu racial type, which is found in Japan. The Ainu also have strong Caucasian features, suggesting some type of ancient white ancestry, although this has to date not been borne out by genetic research. In Oregon, there is a cave known as the Fork Rock Cave, which has been the centre of a number of significant non-biological finds. In 1938, 70 pairs of sandals made of sagebrush were discovered, and radiocarbon dating technology dated them at 9,000 years old. Charcoal was also found with a radiocarbon date indicating it was 13,200 years old. The sagebrush sandals were intricately woven, and the other items found in the cave included projectile points, scrapers, drills, a wooden trigger for a trap, small pieces of basketry, and awls to make leather, or tailored clothing for the Kennewick Man and his peers, all of which indicated highly skilled workers. These items all differ vastly from contemporary Indian artifacts in ancient and North America, and in present-day Indian findings. Red-haired enemies feature a lot in local Indian legends, or what were thought legends, until the discovery of what became known as the Lovelock mummies. The Paiute Indians, the same ones who object to the scientific investigation of the Spirit Cave mummy, had a number of legends dealing with red-haired enemies who they called the Sitikar. Significantly, the main Sitikar means Tule Eaters, Tule being the fibrous reed which is the base material of the mats in which the Spirit Cave mummy was buried. Tule is no longer found in the region, and was likely imported along with the people who used it. According to the Paiute legends, the red-haired peoples were warlike, and a number of the Indian tribes joined together in a long war against them. Eventually, the last of the Sitikar were trapped in what is now called Lovelock Cave. When they refused to come out, the Indians piled brush before the cave mouth and set it aflame. The Sitikar were incinerated. Sarah Winnemucca Hopkins, daughter of Paiute chief Winnemucca, related many stories about the Sitikar in her book, Life Among the Paiutes. On page 75, she writes, "My people say that the tribe we exterminated had reddish hair. I have some of their hair, which has been handed down from father to son. I have a dress which has been in our family a great many years, trimmed with the reddish hair. I am going to wear it sometime when I lecture. It is called a mourning dress, and no one has such a dress but my family." That's a bit macabre, wearing somebody else's hair. In 1931, further skeletons were discovered in the Humboldt lake bed. 80 years later, a mystery skeleton was unearthed on a ranch in the region. In each case, the skeletons were exceptionally tall, much taller than the surrounding Amerinds. There is a small display on the Sitikar in the Lovelock Museum today, but it ignores the evidence which indicates that the Sitikar were not Amerinds. The Nevada State Historical Society also displays some artifacts from the cave. Yet another non-Amerind skeleton has been found at a place called Pyramid Lake, Nevada. The remains are known as the Wizard's Beach Man. This skeleton has been dated at 9,225 years old. Once again, the skull shape is distinctly long, that is, European, and very different to the mongoloid shape of original Amerind racial types. In December 2002, it was announced that a skeleton which had been in Mexico City's National Museum of Anthropology since 1959 had been identified as being more than 13,000 years old, the oldest skeleton yet found in the Americas. Dubbed Pinon Woman III, the skeleton's skull, dolichocraniac or long-faced, was what attracted the attention of scientists, as the Amerind population has broad, mongoloid-shaped skulls. Scientists speculated that the skull was possibly of Ainu extraction, just like the Kennewick man. Those who argue for an ancient white settlement of North America, based on the large number of non-Amerind European-like skeletal remains found on that continent, were boosted by a 1998 announcement on the existence of a genetic link between Amerinds and old European white populations. Proof that they were mixed race, of course. The genetic findings were announced in 1998 by Theodore Schur, a molecular anthropologist from Emory University in Atlanta, at a meeting of the American Association of Physical Anthropologists in Salt Lake City. The data from a genetic marker named Lineage X suggests definitive links between ancient whites and Native Americans. It implies that ancient European peoples who reached North America after first presumably migrating through Asia still retained a distinct genetic makeup, which then passed into New World populations through later physical mingling. According to these Lineage X findings, white populations from Europe were most likely among the North American continent's earliest settlers. The Lineage X markers and possible source populations have been studied by Emory researchers Michael Brown and Douglas Wallace, Antonio Tironi of the University of Rome, and Hans-Jürgen Bandelt of the University of Hamburg. Lineage X, a site of genetic variation, is found in mitochondrial DNA, and thus is passed only through the maternal line. It is one of five markers or haplogroups in mitochondrial DNA, now identified in Native Americans, of which the other four, A to D, are shared by Asians and Amerinds, in accordance with widely accepted theories of their ancient links. The fifth genetic marker, Lineage X, occurs at low frequencies in both modern and ancient remains of Native Americans, and in some European and Middle Eastern groups, including Italians, Spaniards, Finns, Turks, and Bulgarians. Crucially, Lineage X does not occur in any Asian population, including those of Tibet, Mongolia, Southern Asia, or Northeast Asia. Well, that's interesting there, isn't it? It's saying, it's the same mongrelization occurs with Turks, Arabs, basically, that we also get with the Red Indians. Brown and his co-workers had expected to find the genetic marker in Asia, like the other four Native American markers, and are now pressed to account for the gap in their data. This and other evidence persuasively indicates that groups of whites migrated from Europe to North America over 9,000 years ago, and at a later stage mixed with Amerind stock to cause this fifth genetic marker to appear in North America. Well, I would say that it's not necessarily that they migrated from Europe to North America. They could have migrated from Egypt to North America, or from India to North America, or Mesopotamia, or any of these other areas that white people have been in. If the general theory of a white presence in ancient North America is accurate, then it would be logical that such a population would have left behind some buildings or settlements. In this regard, the existence of megalithic structures and even small square building cities on that continent needs to be re-evaluated in light of the new discoveries, as we just outlined. The most dramatic of the early structures on the North American continent is to be found at a site called Mystery Hill, located near the town of Salem, in the American state of New Hampshire. And remember, this is one of the proofs of white people being in China, was the megaliths. We built megaliths all over the world, wherever we went. Here, in Salem, there is a 30-acre megalith site, in many respects identical to those found in Western Europe, and equally as old, and it has been open to the public since 1958. While diggings at the America's Stonehenge site have produced artifacts from most time periods, the most significant find has been an etching which experts have identified as Celtic in nature, raising the tantalizing possibility that it was the subject of an early settlement from the European mainland. And again, I would say that what is called Celtic art is not just found in Europe, but wherever white people have been. In addition to these buildings, a number of ironworking sites have been discovered in North America. Ironworking was foreign to the Amerinds. The presence of 9,000-year-old, seemingly European-like skeletal remains, and these ancient structures, serves as powerful evidence of pre-Amerind whites in North America. All indications are that most of these whites were exterminated in conflict with the Amerinds, with survivors being physically absorbed into the Amerind population. Archaeologists and historians are of the unanimous opinion that the Amerinds did not have smelting or iron casting technology or ability. Yet in a number of areas in North America, remains of iron smelting furnaces have been found. They all follow designs which had previously only been found in Europe. The ability to work iron was one of the single biggest advances which originated with the Indo-Europeans. The most famous of these iron furnaces is to be found on Spruce Hill, a flat-top mountain in the Scioto Valley in south-central Ohio. The collapsed walls of a surrounding fort and other buildings, some 200,000 tons of cut rock, are still to be seen at the site, which was first fully explored by Arlington Mallory in 1948 and detailed in his book The Rediscovery of Lost America. Mallory went on to discover 14 other ironworking sites, which clearly were foreign to the Amerinds, in the Deer Creek Valley, about 10 miles from Spruce Hill. What makes the iron smelting sites so significant is the fact that they are identical to sites found in Europe. At some stage of prehistory, it seems likely that Europeans managed to sail the divide between Europe and North America. Most likely the route taken would have followed the far north from Scandinavia to Greenland, and then possibly along the ice pack coast down into the northeastern seaboard of the North American continent. And I'll just point out here as well that there are records of the Phoenicians actually making it all the way to America, and it could very well have been them that were using this iron smelting and quarrying in America. It doesn't necessarily have to have been Europeans. Well, I mean, obviously white people, but they don't necessarily need to have pushed their boats off from Europe. The mysterious ruins of the cliff dwellings in Nevada and elsewhere in the western United States have baffled archaeologists and historians. Square stone structures were foreign to the Amerinds, and local Indian legends claim that the buildings were first created by a mysterious people called the Anasazi, who inhabited the area before the Amerinds. Given the lineage X and other skeletal evidence proving the existence of whites in America, either prior to, or at the very least simultaneously with, the Amerinds, a strong circumstantial case could be made for white origins of the very white-looking buildings which are currently shown to tourists as Amerind-created structures. Only a racial examination of surrounding grave sites will provide the final answer to the issue. There are hundreds of similar structures to be found all over the Southwest. While all are attributed to Amerinds, the question can rightly be asked, if Amerinds did indeed build these structures, Then why were they living in buffalo skin tents when Europeans colonized that country after the 1500s? The evidence indicates that the first whites in America were killed in open warfare with Amerinds, who may have arrived simultaneously or afterwards, and that the survivors were absorbed into what became the numerically dominant Amerind groups. The existence of the lineage X gene string adds credence to this. As mitochondrial DNA is transmitted only through the female line, it is obvious that the white males were killed by the non-whites, and the white females were taken alive by the Amerinds for sexual purposes. This can be the only reason why mitochondrial gene strings have been found among the Amerinds. The first whites in America disappeared, along with their culture, through a process of racial integration, leaving behind only skeletons and artifacts as evidence of their existence. And next we'll look at Easter Island. For centuries, the stone statues on Easter Island in the Pacific Ocean have baffled historians, but the great Scandinavian explorer and authority, Thor Heyerdahl, in his book Aku Aku, The Secret of Easter Island, uncovered astonishing facts about this island and the ancestors of the people on there. Sadly, Heyerdahl's discoveries have been largely ignored by historians, primarily because of the racial implications that they carry. Heyerdahl discovered, as is detailed in the book, that the leading family on Easter Island to this day has a familial propensity for red hair, fair skin, and thin noses. This is in stark contrast to the rest of the island's population, who are, for the greatest part, dark, flat-nosed, and black-haired. The red-haired people on Easter Island today claim descent from a white people known as the Longears, so-called because they wore large earrings which elongated their earlobes, and who arrived on the island by boat at some stage in history, the exact date of which is unknown. According to the oral tradition of the red-haired descendants on Easter Island, who are now of mixed descent, these first red-haired white people on the island set up a kingdom under one Hotu Matua. These white settlers then created buildings, and as part of their construction work, carved and set up the famous stone statues, which all have long ears and long noses, again in vivid contrast to the flat-nosed natives. The stone statues have been dated at approximately 1,600 years old, meaning that the settlement of the island by these mysterious red-haired whites must have occurred around the year 500 AD. All the while, the tradition goes, the red-haired long-ears used the dark-skinned native inhabitants of the island, whom they called short-ears, as labour. According to the legend, the white, long-eared people were, quote, an energetic people who always wanted to work, and the short-ears had to moil and toil and help them make the walls and statues, which led to jealousy and dissatisfaction. The long-ears' last idea was to rid the whole of Easter Island of superfluous stone so that all the earth could be cultivated. This work was begun on the Poike Plateau, the easternmost part of the island, and the short ears had to carry every single loose stone to the edge of the cliff and fling it into the sea. This is why there is not a single loose stone on the grassy peninsula of Poike today, while the rest of the island is thickly covered with black and red scree and lava blocks. Close quote. Heyerdahl continues the narrative of the oral tradition on Easter Island, quote, now things were going too far for the short ears. They were tired of carrying stones for the long ears. They decided on war. The long ears fled from every other part of the island and established themselves at the easternmost end on the cleared Poike Peninsula. Under the command of their chief, Iko, they dug a trench nearly 2 miles long which separated the Poike Plateau from the rest of the island. This trench they filled with a great quantity of branches and tree trunks till it was like a gigantic far-flung pyre, ready to be set on fire if the short ears on the plain below tried to storm the slope leading to the plateau. But one of the long ears had a short-eared wife. Her name was Moko Pinge, and she was living up on Poike with her husband. She was a traitor and had arranged a signal with the short ears down on the plain. When they saw her sitting, plaiting a large basket, The short ears were to steal in a long line past the place where she sat. One night, the short ears spy saw Moko Pinge sitting and plaiting a basket right at one end of Aiko's ditch, and the short ears stole one by one past the place where she sat, at the very edge of the cliff. They sneaked on along the outer edge of the plateau until they at last had completely surrounded Poike. Another army of short ears down on the plain marched openly up towards the ditch. The unsuspecting long ears lined up to face them and set fire to the whole pyre. Then the other short ears rushed forwards from their ambush, and in the bloody fight which followed, all the long ears were burned in their own ditch. Only three of the long ears succeeded in leaping through the fire and escaping. One of them is called Ororoina, and another Vai, but the name of the third is forgotten. They hid in a cave which the inhabitants can point out to this day. There they were found, and two of them were stabbed to death with sharp stakes, while the third and last, Ororoina, was allowed to remain alive as the only surviving long ear. Ororoina was taken to the house of one of the short ears, who was named Pipi Hireko. There he married a short ear of the Heo family and had many descendants, the last of which are still living on the island now. Well, that's a very prescient legend there, isn't it? About white people going with non-whites, and the non-whites will turn out to be traitors. That's the moral of that story. This is the oral tradition, as recounted in Heyerdahl's book. Most certainly it is, in some way, representative of at least a partially accurate version of events at the easternmost part of Eastern Ireland. Poike is indeed the only place on the island which is strangely clear of stones. It is also cut off from the rest of the island by a ditch, in which evidence of a great fire has been found. The fact that the leading family on the island to this day shows red hair and some European features, even if they have been mixed to a certain degree with the non-white natives, is the clearest sign that the long ears were indeed white people. It was after this great race war on Easter Island that many of the long ears' statues and buildings were pulled down by the non-white natives. Some were simply too big to pull down, and it is those which remain standing today. Originally, many of the famous statues had separate sculptured hairpieces as well. Sadly, many have been knocked off over the course of time, but some remain or have been restored by modern archaeologists. The reason why the hairpieces were carved of separate pieces of rock lies in their colour. These hairpieces were cut of red-coloured stone, which was hewn from a part of the island quite separate from the place where the main statues themselves were cut. The long ears even cut the statues in their own image with red hair. The red-haired whites of Easter Island must have come from somewhere. Heyerdahl studied surrounding regions and found evidence of mixed-race peoples, some with red hair, on the Marquesas Islands near Easter Island. However, Heyerdahl also found, by researching original Spanish accounts of the conquest of South America, that red-haired Incas were present in South America as late as the 1500s. The conquistador Pedro Pizarro reported in his account of the great Spanish invasion of South America in the 1500s that while the masses of Andes Indians were small and dark, the members of the ruling Inca family were tall and had whiter skins than the Spaniards. He mentioned in particular certain individuals in present-day Peru who were white and had red hair. Heyerdahl reported that this is reflected in the mummies found in South America. On the Pacific coast, in the desert sand of Paracas, there are large burial caves in which numerous mummies have been perfectly preserved. Some of the mummies were found to have the stiff black hair of the Indians. Others, which have been kept in the same conditions, have red and often chestnut-coloured hair. Quote, silky and wavy, as found among Europeans, they have long skulls and remarkably tall bodies. Hair experts have shown by microscopic analysis that the red hair has all the characteristics that ordinarily distinguish a Nordic hair type from that of Mongols or American Indians. Close quote. Again, that's from Heyerdahl. Pizarro asked who the white-skinned redheads were. The Inca Indians replied that they were the last descendants of the Viracochas, who were a divine race of white men with beards. They were so like the Spanish that the Incas thought the Europeans were the Viracochas who had come back sailing across the Pacific. According to the principal Inca legend, the sun god Contiki Viracocha had taken leave of his kingdom in present-day Peru and sailed off into the Pacific with all his subjects. When the Spaniards came to Lake Titicaca, up in the Andes, they found the mightiest ruins in all South America, Tiahuanaco. They saw a hill reshaped by man into a stepped pyramid, classical masonry of enormous blocks, beautifully dressed and fitted together, and numerous large statues in human form. They asked the Indians to tell them who had left these enormous ruins. The well-known chronicler, Chiesa de Leon, was told in reply that these things had been made long before the Incas came to power. They were made by white and bearded men, like the Spaniards. The white men had finally abandoned their statues and gone with the leader Contiki Viracocha, first up to Cusco and then down to the Pacific. They were given the Inca name of Viracocha, or sea foam, because they were white-skinned and vanished like foam over the sea. The Spaniards recorded that the ruling Inca families called themselves Orejones, or Long Ears, in contrast to their subjects. Pizarro pointed out that it was especially the Long Ears who were white-skinned. On Easter Island, tradition has it that the Long Ears came from over the sea. Their first king had long ears when he reached the island in a sea-going vessel. This ties in well with the completely separate Inca legend, which says that Contiki Viracocha had long ears when he sailed off westwards across the sea. Heyerdahl's pioneering work shows that drawing upon a number of different evidential strands, red-haired South American mummies, red-haired people on Easter Island, and Inca legends, it is highly likely that a group of white racial types were present in the area in pre-Columbian times. These early whites, possibly linked to Canary Island Guanches, swept across the Atlantic Ocean, settled and built cities and civilizations in South America, and then spread out into the Pacific Islands, or so the evidence argues. There, they were apparently either killed off by the non-white natives or were absorbed into the native population, leaving behind only flashes of their colouring among the inhabitants of the region. The mysterious long-eared and red-haired statues of Easter Island and some of the great ruined cities found in South America appear then to be the legacy of lost white migrations. It is from these ancient people that the legends of white and bearded gods which pervade Inca and Aztec mythology appear to originate. And the moral of all of this is that you cannot have white people living alongside non-whites without the white people being wiped out. We just end up interbreeding with the non-whites. They either rise up against us and genocide us through violence, or we end up interbreeding with them and we become a blended mixed race. And there's no possibility, once you become a blended mixed race, there is no possibility of turning white again. Never in the whole of history has there ever been a case of any of these nations that started out white that then started turning brown. There is no case at all of them ever returning to being white. Look at India, look at China, look at America, look at Egypt, look at the Middle East. I mean, this process must have started slowly. It must have just started with a few white people interbreeding with the non-whites, and the rest of the population must have been absolutely repulsed by this. So how was it that they all turned brown in the end? Well, they must have thought, we can turn these people white again if we have a selective breeding program, and or if we just breed with the ones that look closest to white, with white people, and then they'll become white again. I mean, they must have thought that, because this kind of only happened with a few people at first. And yet that isn't what happened. None of these none of these nations ever got back to being white again. All they did was turn themselves brown and lose what it means to be white in the first place, which means they lost the ability to maintain the civilization. And it became our racial competitors and our enemies if they are in our territory today. White genocide is not something new. And we are just seeing the end of the process now. All these previous civilizations were wiped out through miscegenation, white genocide. And this is why we cannot tolerate race mixing, and we cannot tolerate non-whites in our countries, because we will just end up going the same way as these previous white civilizations. Okay, thank you very much for listening. I will be back on Monday. Have a great weekend. God bless and hail victory.